The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your fortnightly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me. I'm Charles Christian, and with me is Janie. And if you notice my voice is sounding a little bit croaky, this is not me trying to put on some sepulchral tones in the style of Vincent Price. I'm afraid I've just got a cold. I know. Coughs and colds, hexes and sneezes. Some apprentice witch has obviously left a cold spell in the air. Anyway, we've got our usual varied selection of stories for you, but first over to Janie, who's been looking at some of the folklore and traditions associated with today, St. Crispin's Day, the 25th of October. So, Janie, St. Crispin's Day.
Yes, well, I didn't know that the 25th of October was St. Crispin's Day.
And why would you?
No. However, following on from ice cubes, which you may be hearing about or have heard about.
Yes. Chink, chink.
Yeah. St. Crispin Day cards. Make a big thing of it. You know, great commercial idea.
Yeah.
Halloween.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Just wondering. Ooh. However, it's not that exciting, to be fair. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure we could kind of pimp it up a bit.
Pimp up, you said, Crispin.
Yeah. So who are they, you're probably wondering? Well, St. Crispin and his brothers, that was St. Crispian, they were Roman martyrs, apparently. They died in about AD 285. So this is all, you know, quite ancient, British kind of thing. But their cult came to Britain and via France, where apparently they're buried in France. So by tradition, they were shoemakers, and they lived for a little while in Faversham, in Kent.
I've got a little bit of information that it says apparently they were at a house on the site of the Swan Inn in Preston Street.
Right. Yeah. It all seems to be, you know, stacking up the evidence, doesn't it, that is actually true. Well, they were adopted as the patron saints of cobblers and leather workers. And even in some areas, these workers, they held processions and celebrations, much like other trades did on their patron saints days. And there were some other traces of other customers that lasted into the mid-19th century. There was something in Notes and Queries in 1852 that backs this up. It says, in the parishes of Cookfield and Hurst-upon-Pierpoint in Sussex, it is still customary to observe St. Crispin's Day and is kept with much rejoicing. The boys go round asking for money in the name of St. Crispin. Bonfires are lighted, and it passes off much in the same way as the 5th of November.
Mm.
You see? So there's a little bit of credibility there for it. I think we could be on a winner here. But the real lasting resonance, if you like, for the day is patriotic rather than occupational, as it was on the day that the Battle of Agincourt was fought in 1415. That was ever encapsulated in the lines from Act 4, Scene 3 of Shakespeare's Henry V. Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Okay. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbours. So there we are. We can have the big slap-up meal.
Yeah.
And say, tomorrow is St. Crispian. And then he will strip his sleeve and show his scars. That's a bit of a downer, but...
It is.
And say, these wounds I had on Crispin's Day. There you go.
And indeed, that little quote, it goes on to say, it's the famous lines, we few, we happy few, we band of brothers. It's in the same section.
Oh.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. And, yes, people who weren't there, Henry V went on to say, shall hold their manhoods cheap. While any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. Yeah. So there we are.
It was a thing.
It was a thing. And, we'll work on that for next year.
A range of greeting cards is at this very moment.
With showing medieval people with wounded arms.
Yes. We might leave that bit out.
Yeah.
Just have the drinking and the feasting.
And the feasting, yes, and the bonfires. But no fireworks.
Mm.
Good.
And there we are.
Those of you who live in London need no reminding that their capital contains three, not one, but three very good esoteric bookshops. Watkins Books in Cecil Court, the Atlantis Bookshop on Museum Street, and Treadwell's on Store Street. All three put on a regular programme of events, talks, activities. However, here's one that caught my eye. It's... Sunday the 11th of November and Sunday the 2nd of December. And it's a British Museum guided tour with a focus on the awakening of English magic. Since the 1880s, the British Museum has been a focal point for British occultism. Magicians used to meet in the reading room. They studied esoteric texts. They also looked at the pagan deities in the galleries. This tour will take you through the exhibits across the millennia, and your guide will regale you with tales of the Order of the Golden Dawn, Dion Fortune, John Dee, and Aleister Crowley. The guide is Caroline Wise, whose speciality is the mythic London landscape, and she's a consummate raconteur with many adventures of her own to share as well. There's a maximum of 15 people available, spaces available on each tour. Price is £18. You meet at 10:50 a.m. prompt for an 11 a.m. start, and it will run for approximately 3 hours. Use the Montague Place North entrance, entrance to the museum precinct, and rendezvous on the street just in front of the security tent. This event is being put on by Treadwell's, and you can book online, probably the simplest way, https://www.treadwells, that's TREADWELLS, treadwells-london.com/events. That will find you, take you to it. Sounds very interesting. And again, those dates, 11th of November and 2nd of December.
You're listening to the Weird Tales Radio Show with Charles Christian, part of the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
We've had a couple of stories in recent weeks about alcohol and drinking, and to keep up the trend, here's Janie talking about the British royal family and their drinking habits.
Yes, well, not that there's anything wrong, let's just get that straight for Sunday, but this is just little tidbits of information that people may need to know. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting. Anyway, yeah, so Kate Middleton, who is, of course, the Duchess of Cambridge, apparently, her favourite drink is to sip Jack Daniels. But it's a bit of a close call between that and a cocktail called Crack Baby. Yep. which is apparently a mix of passion fruit juice, vodka and champagne that the couple apparently regularly drink at the nightclub Bougies. I've never noticed.
Used to drink there.
They used to drink there, of course.
When they were dating.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Prince Philip is apparently an avid beer lover, with Boddington's being his favourite. He loves beer so much that he's even said to have muttered, "Get me a beer," when he was offered fine wines by the former Prime Minister Giuliano Amato at a dinner in Rome. This is allegedly.
Allegedly.
Get me a bottle of beer.
Yeah. The late Queen Elizabeth, the lovely Queen Mother, drank this drink of 3 parts Dubonnet, 7 parts gin, and a splash of lemon every day.
Not really worth the lemon with that quantity, is it?
I know. My God, just the Dubonnet, let alone with the gin. It was obviously not quite strong enough, having the fortified wine. The Queen, she developed a love for the drink too, enjoying a gin and Dubonnet before lunch and even before bed sometimes.
And before dinner, yeah. Before breakfast.
Well, you would when you've got a hard life like that.
You would indeed, It's a true story here.
Oh, okay.
A friend of mine was a hospital administrator, and they were having a new hospital opened by Princess Margaret, the late Princess Margaret, and they were given specific instructions for her drinking, and it was to leave strategically placed clear glass tumblers, like the sort you'd serve water, with gin in it,
right,
around the room at various places. So it just looked like she was sipping a tumbler of water, but as I say, wherever you went, there was a little glass of gin.
Yeah, again, she probably needed it, you know, to battle through the day.
Yes. What shall I do today? Which crown shall I wear?
Yeah. It does go back. We have more info.
Okay.
King Edward the Sixth. No, the Seventh.
The Seventh.
Yes. Was there a Sixth?
There yes, of course there was. They wouldn't have jumped from Fifth to Sixth.
No, they wouldn't. Seventh.
The Edward the Sixth was sometime in the Middle Ages.
Ah, right. That's why I don't remember.
Yeah.
History, never my strong point. Anyway, Berry Brothers and Rudd's King's Ginger, which you may or may not know, that's a mixture of ginger honey and a base of brandy. It was made specifically for the king after his doctor visited the British company and asked for a liquor to help cure the king of health problems. Oh, my gosh. They kept producing it for the royal family for years until finally opening it up for customers. I mean, that's the sort of doctor you want. Queen Victoria. Many found the Queen's mix of claret and single malt whiskey disgusting, I read. But it was.
It would be fairly disgusting, actually.
How desperate do you need to be to mix those? Or what an incredible ability to tolerate alcohol you have.
She was only a little woman as well.
Oh, she was, yeah.
Tiny, tiny.
She also enjoyed beer with her servants, averaging 8 pints of beer every day. She said it was her servants, but of course, we may know better. Oh, I also found, when I was rooting around, a California company sells luxury ice cubes for $325 per order of 50 ice cubes. I'm assuming they're ice cube size to go in a glass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's $6.50 per ice cube. The company's called Glacé Luxury Ice, and it says its ice is of a higher quality than regular ice, which is made of local tap water and may contain impurities and carcinogens, resulting in poor-tasting and potentially unhealthy ice. According to the company's website, and Glacé Ice, on the other hand, is purified and protected in a resealable package, which ensures its purity, according to the company.
Mm-hmm.
They also sell, as if that wasn't enough luxury, they sell two different types of ice cubes. G-cubed, which is cube-shaped, with each piece individually carved.
Oh, yeah.
And...
That'll look good in your CV. Yeah. What have you been doing? Well, I've been carving ice cubes.
And the Mariko sphere. And the sphere is apparently the most efficient shape in nature and the most mathematically efficient way to cool your drink before... This is according to the company's website. Now, I sat there for wasted a good 20 minutes trying to think of another genius idea that nobody's thought of to luxuriarize, if that's such a word, something ridiculous that, you know, is just water or air or soil or something. And I couldn't think of anything. So I think their genius is in coming up with something to make luxurious that really doesn't need to be.
Yes, frozen water.
Yeah. Because there was that craze, wasn't there? It was a joke, I know, but for pure air in cans. Yes.
Yes.
So that's been done, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for that.
You're welcome.
Of necessity, most of our stories about witchcraft and black magic and casting spells are historical in nature, and we dig back into the medieval past to draw upon them. However, we're going up to date now with a topical news story. And it's the fact that very recently, Saturday the 20th of October, a group of witches based around the Brooklyn Witchcraft Store of Catlin Books decided to aim a hex at the recently appointed Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, a very controversial character in following his confirmation proceedings. The way they conducted it was scheduled to be live streamed on Facebook and Instagram, and apparently 1,500 people applied to Catlin Books to attend the event. And not surprisingly, it's produced a lot of antagonism from the religious right in America, who oppose the use of magic in such a way and really believe that it's the work of the devil. Now, nothing particularly new about this, because it was the same people who, a couple of years ago, tried a similar mass binding spell against the newly appointed 45th President of the United States, Donald Trump. Again, it was organized on social media and performed by witches in the US and around the world. This seems to be, you know, a feature of the modern world and modern social media, but actually, its history goes back a lot longer and goes back to 1940, when Britain was at war with Nazi Germany. This was before the Americans joined the war with us. And there was a very real threat of an invasion by the Germans from France. And there is a story that on Lammas Eve, that's August the 1st, 1940, a group of witches met in the New Forest in England and cast a spell on Hitler to keep the German military from invading Britain. The rituals performed that night has become known as the Operation Cone of Power. The main source of information for all this is Gerald Gardner, who wrote, and indeed is generally regarded as the founder of modern Wicca in the UK. He wrote about it in his book Witchcraft Today, and various biographies about him have also referred to it. And what it says is, on this particular night, in a forest clearing surrounded by pines, they marked out a witch's circle, the stage for their magical efforts. In place of a traditional bonfire, perhaps for fear of being spotted by enemy aircraft or local air defence wardens, A flashlight or shattered lantern was placed to the east of the witch's circle in the direction of Berlin as a focus for their magical assaults. Naked, or sky-clad, as Wiccans like to put it, they began to dance in a spiralling pattern around the circle, building up to the communal ecstatic state that they believed can control magical forces. That's a quote from Philip Heselton in a book he wrote about Gardner called Witchfather. Gardner himself went on to say, "Witches did cast spells to stop Hitler landing after France fell. They met, raised the great cone of power, and directed the thought at Hitler's brain. You cannot cross the sea. You cannot cross the sea. Not able to come. Not able to come." Gardner goes on to say that similar practices were done by their great-grandfathers to prevent Napoleon Bonaparte invading England in the early 19th centuries, and that their even remoter forefathers had done the same to prevent the Spanish Armada landing in the 16th century. Go on, go on, not able to land, not able to land. Gardner goes on to say, "I'm not saying we stopped Hitler. All I say is I saw a very interesting ceremony performed with the intention of putting a certain idea into his mind, and this was repeated several times afterwards. And although all the invasion barges were ready, the fact is Hitler never tried to invade." So there you have it. In later accounts, Gardner said the ritual involved such frenzied dancing and chanting that many of the people involved had ill effects. A couple of them died from exhaustion over the course of the next few days. Gardner and his fellow magic makers never revealed the location of the ritual, but a number of suggestions have been made. One is the Rufus Stone in the New Forest, which was where King William II, or William Rufus, was fatally wounded by an arrow in the year 1100 AD. And there is a long-running rumour, suspicion, that William Rufus was actually a pagan and that he may have been sacrificed in some very late pagan ritual, you know, the Wicker Man killing the king and so on, to ensure the land is fertile for the future. And the alternative is that it may have been somewhere near a large oak tree called the Naked Man, which was where highwaymen used to be hanged and gibbeted back in the 18th century. And there you have it. Basically, a bunch of elderly pensioners scampering around in the nude stopped Hitler invading. It's, of course, leaves obviously open to the obvious critical comment that all these stories only emerged after Hitler had been defeated, and no doubt we'll be hearing after Donald Trump ceases to be president, which is midterm now, and it's only going to be 2 years if he doesn't stand for re-election, that it was the witchcraft spells that brought the end to his presidency.
Find us online at www.urbanfantasist.com or email us at urbanfantasist@icloud.com or follow us on Twitter at Christian Uncut.
With the days getting shorter and Halloween upon us, what better than a story about sinister Scottish castles, ghosts and legends, and blood-soaked history? And no, I'm not talking about Glamis Castle with its notorious secret chamber containing the walled-up remains of a hideous monster, and, coincidentally, ancestor of the current Queen of England. Although I'll mention that a little bit later on. Instead, I'm focusing upon the Hermitage Castle in Liddesdale, which is part of the Borders region between England and Scotland. The original castle was built by the Anglo-Norman de Soulis or de Soules family in the late 12th, early 13th century. Their holding of the Hermitage came to an abrupt end in 1321 when William de Soulis, who'd already switched sides once from fighting for the King of England against the Scots to backing King Robert the Bruce of Scotland against England, his change of heart followed Bruce's victory at the Battle of Bannockburn, and William de Soulis was accused of plotting a rebellion against King Robert. William may have had eyes on the throne himself, or else been planning to place the Bruce's rival, Edward Balliol, on the throne. However, we'll never know his true motivation, as the attempted coup was discovered at an early stage, William was arrested, charged with treason, and subsequently imprisoned in Dumbarton Castle, where he died in mysterious circumstances, which means he was murdered. I'll be returning to the de Soulis family legend later in this story, but for the time being, it's fair to say William's treacherous antics pretty much set the standard for behaviour of all subsequent castellans of the Hermitage. After briefly being recaptured by the English in 1338, it was retaken by Sir William Douglas, known to Scottish history as the Knight of Liddesdale and the Flower of Chivalry. The latter title, it should be noted, refers only to Sir William's military prowess and definitely not to his noble and courteous character, as the following incident reveals. During one of the many wars of independence the Scottish fought against the English during the Middle Ages, particularly in the early 14th century, Douglas developed a great jealousy of his erstwhile comrade, Sir Alfred Ramsay of Dalhousie. In 1342, Sir Alexander and his men recaptured Roxburgh Castle from the English. Now, the titular constable of this castle was Sir William Douglas, and he tried to take it several times but failed. For his efforts, Sir Alexander, the successful capturer of the castle, was appointed the constable of Roxburgh and sheriff of Teviotdale. These appointments outraged Sir William so much that he actually abducted Ramsay and threw him into an oubliette, that's a secret dungeon with access only through a trapdoor in its ceiling, at the Hermitage Castle, where he was left to starve. Legend has it that Ramsay survived for 17 days by eating small quantities of grain that fell through cracks in the floor of the castle granary, which was above the dungeon. Subsequently, his emaciated corpse was found with the fingers gnawed to the bone. Fate, however, caught up with the Knight of Liddesdale in 1353 when he was killed by his own kinsman and godson, confusingly also called William Douglas, in a dispute over land. This member of the Douglas clan, later become the first Earl of Douglas, who was responsible for rebuilding the Hermitage Castle in its current shape. The Douglas family, both the Earls of Douglas, also known as the Black Douglases, and the Earls of Angus, known as the Red Douglases, that's another story for another day, held on to the Hermitage until 1492, when King James IV of Scotland, suspicious that the then Earl of Angus, Archibald Bell the Cat Douglas, was a little too friendly to the point of treason with the English monarch, King Henry VII, and ordered him to give up the Hermitage Castle and hand it over to the Crown. Why was Archibald or Archie Douglas known as Bell the Cat? There's a medieval fable called the Mice in Council, where mice debate how they're going to deal with a dangerous cat that keeps killing them. And someone suggests, what a great idea it would be if we put a bell around the cat's neck so that we'd hear it ringing and it'd warn of his approach. And it said, yeah, great idea. And then it suddenly hit the problem of, well, yeah, but who's going to put the bell around the cat's neck? And so it happened that in 1482, when a group of nobles who wanted to dispose of the then king's favourite, Robert Cochrane, a Lord Grey remarked, "'Tis well said, but who will dare bell the cat?" The challenge was accepted by the Earl of Angus, that's Bell the Cat, Angus, and he began by pulling the chain of office from Cochrane's neck and then ordered the hanging of Cochrane and a few other of his cronies from a bridge. And after that, surprisingly, Archie Douglas was always known as Bell the Cat. But back to our story. Having taken the Hermitage Castle, say it was a royal castle and therefore the king could decide who or not was held the lordship, having taken it from Archie Douglas, the king granted the lands and the lordship of Liddesdale to the Hepburn family, who later became the Earls of Bothwell. Of the Hepburns, James Hepburn, the fourth Earl of Bothwell, is the most notorious as the lover and, briefly, husband of the Scottish monarch Mary, Queen of Scots. To understand the end of James' story, however, we first need to know a little bit more about the man. During a visit to Copenhagen in Denmark in 1559, he met a woman called Anna Trons, or some accounts put it as Trondsen. She was a Norwegian noblewoman whose father was a famous Norwegian admiral, then serving at the Danish royal court. After a brief engagement, or possibly more a marriage under Norwegian law, James and Anna travelled around Europe. However, the relationship ended badly, with Anna complaining that James was only interested in her money, and James abandoned her. It was while he was on these European travels that James first met Mary, then the King of France's wife, in Paris. Later, back in Scotland, James Hepburn married a Lady Jean Gordon. And, however, it didn't last very long, and they divorced the following year with his adultery with one of his wife's servants cited as the cause. Meanwhile, back in Paris, Mary's French husband, the King of France, had died, and so she returned to Scotland, and she returned as queen because she was the only surviving legitimate child of King James V and had technically been the Queen of Scotland since she was 6 days old. However, for the previous 20 years, including the time when she was in France, the country had been run by regents. Mary married her first cousin, Henry Stuart, known to history as Lord Darnley, and they had a son, James, who later became King James VI, as it doesn't help that the Scottish call all their kings James. 8 months later, however, in February 1567, Darnley's residence was destroyed in an explosion, and Darnley was found dead in the garden. However, this was not a tragic accident. The explosion had been caused by 2 barrels of gunpowder going off under Darnley's sleeping quarters, while reports at the time suggest that Darnley showed signs of having been strangled when his body was found in the garden. It should be noted that by this time the relationship between Darnley and Mary was well and truly over. He kept pushing her to make him king, because at the time he was merely the consort of the queen, not a joint monarch. And all the contemporary reports suggest he was an annoyingly unpleasant person. And to cap it all, in March the previous year, this was when Mary was 6 months pregnant, Darnley and a group of nobles had, while Mary was actually still present there, stabbed to death her private secretary, David Rizzio. There again, Rizzio was believed by many people to be the real father of Mary's child. It was a bloody murder. Rizzio suffered a total of 56 stab wounds. Naturally, the relationship didn't really go much better after that. And Mary was suspected of being involved in the plot to kill her husband. However, she was conveniently staying elsewhere on the night of his murder. The prime suspect was James Hepburn, the Earl of Bothwell, who by this time was certainly Mary's lover. However, being a strict Roman Catholic, Mary would not countenance divorcing Darnley. Hepburn was put on trial for Darnley's murder, but acquitted, and the following month, on the 15th of May, he married Mary. This, incidentally, was just a week after Hepburn's own divorce from his second wife. The circumstances leading up to the marriage remain surrounded in controversy. One suggestion is Hepburn kidnapped the Queen and raped her, and the alternative view is Mary was a willing participant in the kidnapping, and the story was a fabrication, so her honour and reputation would not be ruined by her marriage to a man widely suspecting of murdering her husband. I hope you've got that. Yes, it's better to be raped and marry a murderer than to voluntarily marry a murderer. Matrimonial bliss for our star-crossed lovers only lasted a very short time, and within a month, disaster struck. As a study of Scottish medieval reveals, rather than uniting against a common enemy, the English, that's us lot, the Scottish nobility spent the best part of 500 years fighting among themselves over land, clan rivalries, dynastic claims, power at court. By the 16th century, they'd also add religion to the mix. Mary's marriage to Hepburn was a step too far, alienating not only the Protestant nobility, who resented Hepburn's power, but also Mary's Catholic followers, who were shocked by her behaviour. With the country seemingly on the verge of another civil war, Mary and Hepburn's forces met their opponents, known as the Confederate Lords, at a place called Carbery Hill, which is just east of Edinburgh. This was on the 15th of June. Rather than a battle, although a few shots were fired, it was more than a day-long standoff, ending with the Queen's forces gradually drifting away and abandoning the field. And that was it. Their army was gone. Mary and Hepburn shared one final embrace, then she surrendered and he quickly fled the battlefield. For Mary, who was still only 24 at this point, it was the start of the slippery slope that would see her abdicate in favour of her son, that's James VI. She'd escape a Scottish prison, be driven into exile in England, and subsequently be imprisoned and later beheaded at Fotheringay Castle in 1587, almost 20 years to the day after Darnley's murder, after being convicted of encouraging a Roman Catholic plot to assassinate Queen Elizabeth of England. Today, her ghost is said to still haunt the Hermitage Castle, seen as one of her more romantic trysts with Hepburn. As for Hepburn, his fate was no less cruel. After fleeing Carbery Hill, he eventually sailed across the North Sea, heading for Denmark, where he hoped to raise an army to restore Mary to power in Scotland. However, he actually made landfall off the coast of Norway, which was then ruled by Denmark, and was escorted into Bergen Harbour because he lacked proper papers. Unfortunately, Bergen was the hometown of Anna Thronsen. Remember her, the first wife? She promptly had him arrested and sued for abandonment and for the return of her dowry. There is a possibility that Hepburn could have wiggled his way out of trouble here, but then the Danish monarch, a King Frederick, got to hear of the arrest. Frederick knew the English government was looking for Hepburn in connection with Darnley's murder, and he also recognised that if Mary ever did regain the Scottish crown, having Hepburn as a hostage would be a valuable bargaining chip. So he had Hepburn transferred from Bergen to a prison fortress near Copenhagen. Tragically, when news from both Scotland and England confirmed Mary would never again become Queen of Scots, Hepburn's value as a hostage plummeted, and the king had him imprisoned in a place called Dragonsholm Castle, where he was chained to a pillar in a dungeon and forgotten. Hepburn spent the last 10 years of his life chained to that pillar. You can still see the circular groove his shackles carved out into the floor, and he eventually died there, raving insane, in April 1578. In fact, you could still see what was claimed to be his mummified body in the crypt of a nearby church until a few decades ago. But we've not yet finished with our bloody history of the Hermitage Castle. After Hepburn, the next recorded keeper of the Hermitage Castle was his cousin, Francis Stuart, who also became the Earl of Bothwell. He was a grandson of King James V, albeit an illegitimate one, and was viewed as a potential alternative to James VI. He was certainly an inveterate dabbler in politics and intrigue, and in 1591 he was arrested, tried and imprisoned for his supposed involvement in the infamous North Berwick witchcraft trials. This was a moral panic largely instigated by King James VI, described by a contemporary as the wisest fool in Christendom. And James was obsessed with witchcraft. In fact, he wrote a book about it, Demonology, which was published in 1597. James's belief was that there were a large number of witches and sorcerers in the Berwick area, which was a seaport town, who had used black magic to try to sink a fleet of royal ships travelling between Norway and Scotland. Francis Stuart was in fact pardoned, but a few months later he was accused of being involved in yet another plot against James. So he was stripped of his powers and the hermitage was granted to a guy called Sir Walter Scott, known as the Bold Buckley. Scott was a notorious border reaver, which is a polite name for a bandit and livestock rustler, and also an ancestor of the famous novelist Sir Walter Scott of some 300 years later. And this one, the Bold Buckley, almost started a war in 1596 between England and Scotland when he attacked Carlisle Castle and successfully liberated Willie Armstrong, another famous border reaver. War was only averted after Buckley rode south from the hermitage and personally apologised to the Queen of Elizabeth. However, this was the last hurrah for the hermitage, as in 1603 Elizabeth died and King James of Scotland ascended the throne of England. At a stroke, the union of the crowns, which is why King James is known as King James VI of Scotland and King James I of England, rendered castles like the hermitage redundant, as there was no longer any need for a fortified border. And within a very short period, the Liddesdale fortress was abandoned and falling into disrepair. There does, however, remain one final mystery, namely, why did the hermitage have such a dark history involving so much cruelty and treachery, even by the standards of those cruel and treacherous times? It was the Romans in classical times who developed the idea of the genius loci, or the spirit of a place, who would protect and bring good luck to the occupants of a home or villa. The corollary of this is some places seem to be permeated with such tragedy, horror and bad luck. You can only assume they are cursed, for want of a better term, by a maleficus spiritus loci, or evil spirit of a place. At the Hermitage, there is a ready-made candidate for this in the shape of the legend of Robin Redcap. Sometimes you'll see this character referred to as Redcap Sly. Robin Redcap is said to be a particularly malevolent and murderous goblin who served as the demonic familiar of one of the original owners of the Hermitage Castle. The 19th century writer Sir Walter Scott, that's the descendant of the border reaver who actually owned the castle at one stage, in his collections, The Minstrelsy of the Scottish Borders, records a ballad written by John Leyden some 100 years earlier called Lord Soulis. However, Scott misidentifies evil Lord Soulis as the historical character William de Soulis, the one who was murdered at Dumbarton in 1321. Historians now suggest the individual in question was actually Sir Ranulph de Soulis, who was born around 1150 and murdered by his servants in the winter of 1207-1208. The official version of his death suggests he was killed by his servants and tenants because he was a cruel and oppressive landlord. The unofficial version says he was actually a sorcerer who had been sacrificing local children as part of his black magic rituals, and the locals executed him as a way to halt his evil ways. Let's delve a little deeper into this legend. Evil Lord Soulis had apparently sold his soul to the devil, and in exchange he was given Robin Redcap as his familiar and assistant. Redcap is described as a short, thick-set old man with long, prominent teeth, skinny fingers armed with talons like eagles, large eyes of a fiery red colour, and grisly hair streaming down his shoulders. He also wears iron boots for stomping on the bones of his victims, carries a pike staff in his left hand for spearing his victims, and sports a red cap on his head, which he soaks in his victim's blood, giving it a crimson hue. Apparently, the only protection against Red Cap is to repeat the words of the scripture or to hold up a cross. And then he will utter a dismal yell and vanish in flames, leaving behind a large tooth on the spot where he was last seen. Robin Redcap apparently lived in an iron chest secured by three strong padlocks and could only be summoned by Lord Ranulph knocking on it three times. As part of the demonic pact, Lord Soulis was also protected by an unholy charm against any injury from rope or steel. This meant he could not be killed by swords, daggers or axes, and he could not be shackled by chains or rope, and he could not be hanged. However, he was not immortal, and on the advice of the famous Borders laird and mystic Thomas the Rhymer, like Sir Ranulph, an actual historical character, Lord Soulis was rolled up in a sheet of lead, rather like you'd wrap somebody up in a roll of carpet, then carried up to the nearby Ninestane Rig Neolithic stone circle, dropped in a large cauldron over a blazing fire, and boiled to death. The Victorian-era writer, spiritualist and journalist W.T. Stead sums up Lord Soulis's fate neatly in this poem. On a circle of stone they placed the pot. On a circle of stones, but barely nine, they heated it up red and fiery hot till the burnished brass did glimmer and shine. They rolled him up in a sheet of lead for a funeral pall. They plunged him into the cauldron red and melted him, lead, bones and all. That was the end of Lord Soulis. However, Ranulph Soulis's ghost is said to return to haunt the Hermitage Castle every 7 years, the spectre making its way around the castle's vaults and dungeons, which still echo with the screams of his victims. As for Robin Redcap, he too is said to still haunt the castle and to meet up with the shade of his master, Lord Soulis, every 7th year. So be warned, the next 7 years cycle occurs in 2 years' time in 2020. Now, little bit of background information. If you want to visit the Hermitage Castle today, it has been partly restored and is managed by the Scottish Government Agency Historic Environment Scotland and is open to the public from April till the end of October. Its location is Newcastleton in Roxburgh, Scotland. And the present ruins date back to the 14th century, taking the form, a very distinct form, of a tower house keep with an enormous gatehouse. This replaced the earlier Moton Bailey Castle. And I also said I'd tell you a little bit about Glamis and its legends. I couldn't just leave you with the fact that there was a monster in a sealed room that was a relation of the Queen of England. Well, the bloody history of Glamis Castle begins in the 11th century when King Malcolm II was murdered there. Shakespeare makes the castle the home of the murderous Macbeth. And in the 14th century, Glamis became the home of the Lyon family, now Bowes Lyon, and remains their property. First as the Thanes of Glamis, later Lords, and now the Earls of Strathmore and Kingshorn. And the late Queen Mother, that's the mother of the current English monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, was born there in 1900. As for the ghosts of Glamis Castle, well, we are heading towards Halloween. There is a tongueless woman, said to be a serving girl who had her tongue cut out to prevent her talking about her illicit affair with one of the lords of Glamis. Her ghost is sometimes seen looking out from a barred window. Then there is the Grey Lady, believed to be the ghost of Janet Douglas, the Lady of Glamis, who was unjustly convicted of witchcraft and burned at the stake in Edinburgh in 1537. There is the ghost of Jack the Runner, a black slave boy supposedly killed by one of the earls, who hunted him down with a pack of hounds in a perverse variation of fox hunting. And there is Earl Beardy, said to be Alexander Lindsay, the Earl of Crawford, who died sometime around about 1453. He was a visitor to the castle and one Sunday night in a drunken rage said if he couldn't find someone to play cards with, nobody wanted to play cards with it, take him up on his offer because it was the Sabbath day. He said if he couldn't find anybody to play cards with him, he'd play with the devil himself until doomsday. Be careful for what you wish for. A few minutes later, according to the story, there was a knock at the castle door, and there stood a tall stranger in a long dark coat, who asked if Earl Beardy still needed someone to play cards with. He was shown to the Earl's room, and they played all night, but come the morning, the stranger had disappeared. Take him with him, the Earl's soul. Now, says the legend, Earl Beardy's ghost is trapped in a secret room in the castle, doomed to keep playing cards with the devil for all eternity. And talking of secret rooms, undoubtedly the most famous legend associated with Glamis tells of a secret room or suite of rooms that was the home, in effect a prison, of a hideously deformed child of the Bowes Lyon family, a child who was the rightful heir to the earldom. This was reputedly Thomas, the grandson of the 11th Earl of Strathmore, who was born in 1821. Known as the Monster of Glamis, no subtlety there, he is described in one account as half-man, half-toad, and in another as having a chest like an enormous barrel, hairy as a doormat, with a head that ran straight into his shoulders, but with toy-like arms and legs. When he died, the rooms were bricked up so the awful secret could be kept from the world, a secret that was subsequently only passed on from the Earl to his eldest son. Curiously, there is another, far more shameful but probably more historical accurate legend associated with the secret rooms bricked up within the walls of Glamis Castle. This dates back to 1486, when members of the Ogilvy clan, who were on the run from their enemies, the Crawfords, Earl Beardy was one of the Crawfords, the Ogilvy clan turned up at the castle seeking sanctuary from the then Lord of Glamis. He granted them sanctuary and had them taken to a room deep within the castle, and then had the door locked and barricaded from the outside. 4 weeks elapsed before anyone bothered to look inside the room again, but by then only one Ogilvy was still alive, having survived by eating the emaciated corpses of his fellow clansmen. Not that it did any good, as Lord Glamis promptly had him killed, and the room permanently bricked up, presumably to conceal his betrayal of a promise of sanctuary. This walled-up chamber is sometimes referred to as the Room of Skulls. So if there's a moral of that story, be careful of which Scottish castles you stay in. And now here's Janie, who's been looking at the autumn phenomenon of angel hair.
Yes, and why? Because we were walking across the fields with the dogs, ploughed fields, getting towards sunset, and all you could see for hundreds and hundreds of yards, I mean acres and acres and acres, were what looked like cobwebs.
Yes.
But were they?
Ooh.
I had to find out.
Yes.
Yes. There's a thing called angel hair. And it's a sort of sticky, stringy substance that has been reported in connection with UFO sightings.
Ooh.
Or manifestations of the Virgin Mary.
Ooh.
And this it must be the same thing. It's described as being like a cobweb or jelly. I wouldn't have said jelly, but anyway. It's called angel hair because obviously it's similar to fine hair. It's also called spider's webs. In some cases, it's been found to be the web of migrating spiders, which is what I tended to think it was, to be fair. But reports of angel hair say that it disintegrates or evaporates within the short time of forming, which, you know, spider's webs don't really. It's also an important aspect of the UFO religion, realism. One theory among ufologists is that it's created from ionized hair sleeting off an electromagnetic field that surrounds a UFO. Well, the field bit's right, isn't it?
Yes, the field's right, yes.
Okay. Sightings. all around the world, apparently, from way back, reported during 1561, a celestial phenomenon over Nuremberg. Also, the miracle of Fatima on the 13th of September and in October, which is about the time we saw it, 1917. Apparently, the most widely reported incident occurred in France in 1952. That's when I was born. When great flakes were reported as falling from a nearly cloudless sky. I can't read my notes, sorry. Yes, carry on.
I was going to say, apparently, it's thought to be mainly a little money spider.
That does
a thing called ballooning, where they move from one area to the other by shooting a fine web out of their web orifice, and it catches the wind and carries them.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, there must have been millions of them then, because this was acres and acres and acres of land.
I have a statistic here from a man who clearly had nothing better to do with his life, called William Bristow, who counted the number of spiders in fields in Bexhill in Sussex. And he found that there were, on average, 2 million spiders to the acre.
Oh, that was what I reckoned.
Yeah. You know.
It has to be. It has to be, because it's just incredible phenomenon to see it. Mm. So published explanations, i.e. a sort of more scientific explanations, that does tend to think it's spiders who migrate through the air in large numbers on cobweb gliders.
Yeah.
And many, many cases of angel hair are found to be these spider threads. And they've even found spiders on the material. So the link is fairly close.
Yes.
If anybody's interested, it's Linifidae spiders that they think cause these showers of gossamer threads in England and the Northern Hemisphere.
Yes. That's the posh name for money spiders.
Right. Oh, you know everything, don't you? Australia, New Zealand, they have a lot of cases caused by their native spiders of a similar type of species.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
In 1940, a particularly warm and settled early autumn, gossamer was seen drifting across the downs of southern England, and it was suspected to be a device of the enemy. A golfer claimed that his wrists had been blistered by the stuff. And rumours reached the government that a new and mysterious form of chemical warfare was being tested. And in Hampshire, the Home Guard was called out to inspect a field of angel hair. Fortunately, one of them had read a article. I think you've got a note of it there. Gilbert White and his Natural History of Selborne, which goes back to 1741, and he said, no, it's spiders.
Yes.
And another little factoid here. Since the gossamer usually occurs in the autumn, this used to be the time of the goose fairs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was held, it must be the down from fine feathered birds, and that it actually is a combination. So gossamer is a combination of goose and summer.
Well, that's an interesting little tidbit.
Yes.
Not that I ever worried or thought about where the word gossamer came from, but there we are.
No.
It's all information we need to know.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's all I have to say about angel hair.
Well, that's brilliant.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
My work is done.
Goodbye then.
Goodbye.
Till the next time.
Goodbye.
That's it. We're almost out of time. Janie and I look forward to joining you again next time. But until then, good night.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon.
which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales Radio Show with Charles Christian, your fortnightly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, magic and folklore. Keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com or by email at urbanfantasist@icloud.com and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Good night. Join us again in 2 weeks' time for another edition of the Weird Tales Radio Show.